Hi, this is Colin McCallan. Thank you for listening. Please do us a favor and leave us a 5-star review wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe so that you don't miss any future episodes. Thank you.
Welcome to Is This Legal? Here are your hosts, attorneys Colin McCallan and Russell Hebbets.
Hello, 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 everyone. My name is Russell Hebbets, and I am here with my partner, Colin McCallan, for another episode of Is This Legal?
Hello.
Today, we're going to be talking about a couple of different cases. One, we're going to be revisiting the Jennifer Crumbley case. So that was the podcast topic that we did last time we dropped it. And when we gave that, when we signed off, the jury was out on that case, so since then, the jury has come back.
Yeah.
So we're going to talk about how our predictions looked and why they may or more likely may not have been correct.
Yeah, Russ and I were flat out wrong on this one. We went 0 for 2. And, you know, we've talked about that a little bit because, you know, some of our listeners also kind of expressed some surprise about the verdict. Some people thought it was right on the money, but we did spend some time talking about that trial, and now we are in a position where we have some hindsight with us, so we can kind of assess this in a little bit more detail.
We're going to break out those 2020 spectacles and tell you what happened
those
and
bifocals.
Why it happened. Right. And then we're also going to be talking about the happy case of Robert Du Bois.
Yeah.
At least it ended happy. It wasn't happy for about 37 years.
No, it wasn't.
This is a case of a exoneration of a man who was serving a life sentence in Florida. And so we'll talk about kind of what happened there.
I do love those stories. Can't wait to fill you in. So hang on till the end there. Of course, we got a DCOTW. We got an Is This Legal? We're all packed in here, right?
We have it all for you. Yep. So let's start off. You know, Colin, you kind of set us up on the Jennifer Crumbley thing. You know, we both gave our predictions.
Yeah.
And both of our predictions were, this is really tough to prove.
Right.
And there's a bit there and there's a lot there, but neither of us thought that it was going to get to the point where a jury could find her guilty beyond a reasonable doubt for the actions of her son, Ethan Crumbley.
That's exactly right. We thought that there might be too much of a disconnect between Jennifer Crumbley and the act that her son committed in the school, where maybe they wouldn't assign criminal blame to Jennifer Crumbley. Well, as we've been discussing, we were incorrect about that. The jury did say she is guilty of involuntary manslaughter. Basically, they are saying she was a causal link
right
to the deaths of these four individuals, and that she needs to be held criminally responsible. Russ, let's talk about what's next for her. What is she exposed to now that she's been convicted?
So before I go into it, anyone who right now jumped in on this episode as your first episode and didn't listen to our last one, you need to listen to the last one first.
Absolutely.
To get the perspective. We're talking about the mass shooting committed by Ethan Crumbley in Oxford High School in Michigan. And we're going forward with the expectation that you're up to speed on that. So if not, go listen to our last episode.
I think that was episode 110. Yeah.
Okay, perfect. So going back to your question, what is she looking at? She has sentencing. Jennifer Crumbley is scheduled for sentencing on April 9th of this year, and she is facing a maximum of 15 years for each of the 4 counts of involuntary manslaughter that she was convicted of. If the judge wanted to max her out and sentence her consecutively for each different witness or victim, she could be looking at a maximum of 60 years in prison for this
wow
action that her son took.
Mm-hmm.
Now, judge doesn't have to do that. Judge doesn't have to max her out. Judge does not have to give consecutive sentences. So, you know, she could be looking at significantly less time than that, and I would expect her to be looking at significantly less than 60 years. Where that will fall, I really don't know.
I don't either. I mean, again, this is a novel situation, and there's really not a lot of either binding legal precedent or non-binding legal precedent that would give a judge of guidance of what is an appropriate sentence here.
Right.
So, and honestly, I feel like it's wide open. I mean, I think the defense still has really good arguments to say, okay, even nevertheless, despite the fact that she was found guilty, you know, there are different types and degrees of involuntary manslaughter. And this is a person who wasn't even at the scene of the crime. This is a person who never even pulled the trigger.
Who didn't know it was going to happen.
Exactly. Right. Certainly didn't intend for any of this to happen. There's no intent. You know, so you really lean into that stuff. But of course, the other side to this is just the awful tragedy that this case represents. You know, four kids dead.
Yeah,
it's an immeasurable tragedy, and you can feel the need for accountability.
Well, and the jury found that she was culpable for it. Mm-hmm. The jury found that but for her inaction, this would not have happened. So the jury has kind of taken it out of the judge's hands and said she's criminally responsible for this. So, I mean, it's going to be years for sure. I just don't know if it's going to be years or decades.
Right, exactly.
Right.
Well, Russ, let's unpack the trial a little bit more, because I think we have access to more information about the trial than we did when we first started talking about the podcast when the trial was ongoing. But you know, we spent a lot of time talking about the fact that this was a case where we really felt Jennifer Crumley needed to get on the stand and testify. We both felt strongly about that. Russ, the verdict being what it is, do you think we were wrong about that? Do you think that she should have sat down and not taken the stand?
So again, hindsight being 20/20, it's really tough to say. I will tell you this. Based on her trial testimony and trial demeanor, I think that it looks like to us that there was not enough preparation done with her as a witness.
I think you're absolutely right, Russ. So what are some of the things that stood out to you as being, okay, boy, you weren't ready for that question?
Yeah, so a big statement that she made while on the stand is she said, I wouldn't have done anything differently.
Yeah.
Now, there was an interview with the jury foreperson, and that foreperson confirmed that statement, that quote, I wouldn't have done anything differently, was repeated often in the jury room. Because remember what we said, what Colin and I said, is the reason to put someone on the stand is to gain sympathy mm-hmm. and to show that vulnerability, and it's to make that person likable and have some empathy from the jury towards that person.
Right.
Statements like, four people are dead, multiple students are injured, this completely was a massive upheaval in the community, and I wouldn't have done anything differently.
Yeah, I think. So, Russ, what I'm wondering about, because we just don't know this, is whether that was her prepared answer, or whether that was just something that she said on the fly, okay? Now, Let me kind of go back to what Russ was saying. Russ and I do believe that there really can be great value in having the defendant take the stand and testify, but it has to be done in a very certain way. It has to be done in an honest, credible way. Okay, if I were Ms. Crumbly's attorney, I would have prepared her for that question because it's a foreseeable question the prosecutor might ask her. Because the thinking, of course, is, would you have done anything differently? She's saying she's not guilty, that she didn't do anything wrong. So, you know, I can see her attorney saying, you need to say you did nothing wrong. You need to say confidently that, you know what, I wouldn't change a thing. The problem with that, Russ, is that to me, like you just mentioned, like you just alluded to, it does not feel honest or genuine. I mean, I think any parent in this situation, whether they were charged with a crime or not, would probably, the true answer to that question, and I think the better answer to the question, is to say, of course, I think about this every day. I think of many different things I could have done differently. I should have taken him home that day from school. Maybe we should have taken more care into how we handled the weapon. And, you know, what you're doing as the defense attorney asking these questions, you're kind of intentionally beating your own client up in order to strike sympathy with the jury. You're trying to get the jury to understand, okay, this woman actually does acknowledge she might have made some mistakes, but yet, you know, we our heart goes out to her. She's accountable for this.
And here's, like, you could be sitting there saying, well, How was it foreseeable that the DA would ask that specific question? And I hear you. You know, that specific question, maybe that's not something you prepare for. But you know what they did know? They knew that she had texts that she had sent to her lover at the time saying she was a failure as a mother, as a parent, right?
Exactly. The text was she sent to a person she was having an affair with right after this. She sent a text that said, "I failed as a parent. I failed miserably." Now, the prosecutor asked her about that because they had her text messages. And again, any reasonable defense attorney who's worth their salt is going to know that she's going to be confronted about text messages that they have in evidence.
Yeah, and to be very clear, the defense was aware of these texts. Like, they knew about these and should have known that this was going to be a line of questioning.
Right. And so now she gets confronted by the prosecution. They say, "Well, you remember when you sent that text, I failed as a parent, I failed miserably. Do you still feel that way?" is what they asked her. This is her response. "I don't think I'm a failure as a parent, but at the time, I guess I didn't see. I felt bad that Ethan was sad at these things, and I guess I failed somewhere." Okay? I think, again, I feel like that might have been a prepared statement for her from her attorney saying, "This is how you answer this, kind of be defiant." And honestly, I don't like it. I think it makes her look too sanctimonious.
It does.
I think what she needed to say is something like, "You know what? Of course, I still feel this way. You know, my son's in prison for the rest of his life. People are dead. I think about this every day." And I think that she kind of somewhat defiantly distanced herself from this, maybe a little too aggressively with the way she's answering these questions.
I mean, I absolutely agree. Like, she is, I think this was a failure on her defense team's part, right? Well, because she really had to take at least some, she had to at least acknowledge that she could have done things differently.
Right.
She had to acknowledge that there were problems here. I mean,
she's got to read the room, right? She's got to understand that four kids are dead at her son's hand. And it's not going to serve her to kind of say, I wouldn't change a thing.
And the difference is, you know, her admitting that she could have done things differently, that is not an admission of criminal liability.
Absolutely.
Right? That is an admission that, hey, there were things on multiple levels for multiple people that could have been done to stop this tragedy, and she was one of those people who could have done something differently.
Yeah, I think her defense team could have done a little bit of a different theme here. I think they could have said, "You know what? She made mistakes, and she, you know, absolutely, with hindsight being what it is, she could have acted differently here. She was a bad mom. It doesn't mean she's guilty of involuntary manslaughter of four people. There's a difference between those things."
Yeah.
And I think if they had, you know, let her kind of be more honest and kind of show, "You know what? I'm not perfect.
Right.
I'm actually far from perfect. Right. I grieve for the mistakes that I made in this case, and I really wish I could have done something different. But yeah, man, I agree with you. I think that attitude did not help her well."
Yeah, I'll tell you the other thing that the foreperson said that made a difference to them was the fact that Jennifer Crumbly was the last person seen with the gun with Ethan. She said that hammered it home. That's a tough one to deal with, because what she's talking about is there was a video that the prosecution played from about 4 days prior of Ethan and Jennifer at the shooting range.
Right. And that is super interesting, Russ, because, again, after we put our last podcast out, before the verdict came out, the jury was out, by the way, on this for a day and a half.
Yeah.
And apparently the foreperson said that this was a really tough one. There were people on both sides of the aisle that were advocating for their position before they were eventually to get that unanimous verdict. But they asked a question to the judge during their deliberations. And the question related, I don't remember what it was specifically, but it related to, "Your Honor, what are we supposed to infer from the lack of evidence regarding Jennifer Crumbly's handling of the gun?"
Right.
And I think what they were asking is, "We haven't heard really any evidence about where the gun was from the time of the shooting range to the time of the shooting." And Russ, I'll tell you right now, when I heard them ask that question, I thought even it was even more likely that she was going to get acquitted, because I'm thinking, okay, you literally have the jury asking about a lack of evidence that the prosecution has presented with regard to who had the gun and where. this is really good for Miss Crumbly.
Right. And you may be thinking, you know, why didn't the defense call James Crumbly to testify that he was responsible for the gun? Because that's what she testified to, that it was
right.
It was her husband's responsibility to secure the gun. The problem with that is they can't do that because James Crumbly is set for trial and has an absolute Fifth Amendment right to not testify to anything that could be incriminating against
him. That's correct. Yeah, he was not going to be able to be a witness in this trial at all.
So the defense doesn't really have the ability to rebut that, other than Jennifer's testimony, which by the statements from the foreperson, the jury didn't find terribly credible.
Right.
So that's a problem that you don't really have an answer to. And that's the kind of thing, you know, that you have to assess whether it's worth it to put her on the stand or not. That's part of that calculus.
I will still say, even looking back on it, I still think you put her on the stand. I stand by that. I think the case is just too emotionally heavy for the jury to not hear anything from the Crumbly side. That's my take on it. Would things have changed? I don't know.
Right.
We'll never know. But
well, let's talk about, Colin, how this, you know, we talked previously in our last podcast about the fact that this case does not create any binding precedent
right.
on any other courts.
That's correct.
You know, but this case really does create a non-legal, non-technical, non-binding precedent, doesn't it?
Yes. I mean, I think that prosecutors around the country just saw that this type of case can be prosecuted successfully. And I think a very difficult case for the prosecution. I mean, I stand by that. I think this was a super close call. Maybe this could have gone in a different direction with a completely different jury.
Right.
But, you know, I think that there seems to be, you know, we just had this Kansas City Super Bowl shooting. I'm just feeling like more and more there's this need for people to do more. And prosecutors might be looking at this whole situation as like, okay, here's how we can do more. We're not going to go after the shooter. We're going after their family. We're going after anybody that could have touched this, that could have prevented this. And maybe that's going to be enough where people start thinking, okay, gosh, if I have criminal liability for my son or daughter's conduct, maybe I'm going to take gun safety, gun responsibility more seriously.
I think that's the hope. And I do think that it will encourage other DA's offices to charge more parents in cases like this. And I really do think it's a slippery slope. I really do think that. Now, she clearly made some big errors in assessing her son's mental health and assessing, you know, his danger to the community. Like she definitely, and the jury found her criminally liable. So that, but, you know, the other side of that is the DA's literally had 2 years to go through her life with a fine tooth comb to pick up any little mistake she made.
They really threw the kitchen sink at her.
They did. And that is tough for anyone. I mean, right now, I would not want someone to critique my parenting for the past 2 years. You know, like I've made some mistakes, you know, but I guess ultimately, you know, that's neither here nor there. That basically just says that really is tough to survive that kind of scrutiny in hindsight.
I mean, I will say the defense did attack that argument. I mean, I read some of the closing argument that Ms. Crumbly's attorney made, and she was really kind of trying to sell that idea of this lady's just like you and me, you know. In fact, several times the defense attorney referred to herself like, I'm a mom. I get it. I've got 2 kids. I'm not perfect. No one is. This is an impossible situation. Have some sympathy. I mean, I think she tried to do what we're talking about. I don't know. There might have been some missteps with the testimony. So, but we'll never know. We will know about her sentencing, though, which again happens on April 9th. So we might provide an update once we find out what her fate is.
And a quick update on her husband, James Crumbly, who is pending trial right now. His attorney just filed a motion for change of venue. So that is basically...
Yeah, how's he feeling, by the way?
Yeah, probably not great. Probably not great.
Right.
So he is he is basically saying it's impossible for me to get an unbiased jury in this county, given the extensive media coverage, including the fact that this very dramatic trial with my wife just concluded.
Yeah.
I think it's unlikely that that is going to be granted.
I agree.
I think it's going to stay in, I think it's Oakland County, although don't quote me on that. But I think that it's going to stay there. I don't think it's going to get moved. And I think he's going to go to trial absent some other development shortly.
So, yeah, a fascinating case. We got a lot of feedback from our listeners on this one. So we will update you guys accordingly with the sentence of Jennifer and James's trial coming up. But let's go ahead and take a break right now to play Is This Legal? We will be back on the other side of the break.
And on that flip side, we're going to be talking about Robert Dubois and his exoneration.
Is it Dubois or Dubois? Those French pronunciations always throw me off, man. Yeah,
I'm going to say Dubois.
Okay.
You we'll say Dubois. We'll cover it. We're not going 0 for 2 anymore. I mean, we've already eaten enough crow.
All right. Stay tuned.
Welcome, everyone. Are you ready to play
Is This Legal?
We're working on that. We're trying out different things to see what works, and I think we're finding out a lot what doesn't work.
I mean, I feel like we get better every time.
Yeah.
Because we started at a pretty low bar.
We got to get Jason in here to record some new jingles. I don't know. Russ, what is it time for here? What are we doing?
So we are playing our game show style game where you, the listener, gets a fictional scenario with our friends Jebediah and Cornelius, and we ask you, is it legal? What's the legal answer to this scenario?
Yeah, we've been talking a lot this podcast about whether we were right or wrong. What about you? Are you right or wrong?
Right. Have you been keeping track? Are you batting over 500 out there?
Yeah, we'll see.
All right, well, here we go. For today's episode, Jebediah gets arrested by Officer Cornelius for stealing a beautiful moto car.
Shocker.
From a private residence in Northamptonshire. A witness claims to have seen Jebediah driving the car down a country road shortly after it was stolen and near where it was found abandoned later. As he does oft when he gets in these sticky situations, Jebediah calls Myrtle, his lawyer and sometimes girlfriend, to represent him. In preparation for their defense, Myrtle asks whether Jebediah stole the moto car in question. Jebediah admits to her that he did. He nevertheless demands to go to trial because he thinks the case against him is weak. Jebediah takes the stand in his own defense. While testifying on the stand and under oath, he says he didn't steal the car. He wasn't even in Northamptonshire when the car was stolen. Myrtle does not offer to correct his testimony or to approach the bench and tell the judge the inconsistency. She does nothing. Which of these answers best describes Myrtle's conduct?
Interesting.
A. She did nothing wrong. B. She committed an ethical violation. C. She committed a civil violation. Or D, she committed a criminal violation.
Man, okay. So we're just kind of starting to see that maybe this could be a toxic relationship between Myrtle and Jebediah, right? I mean, kind of before we get into the legal nuts and bolts of this whole thing. I mean, does anybody kind of feel like Myrtle is, I don't know, she needs to get out of this somehow. I mean, she keeps hanging out with this guy. He keeps getting in trouble, but she keeps feeling sorry for him and representing him. She keeps getting him off the hook.
I mean, it's hot and cold. It's you know.
Yin and yang. It's
fire and ice.
Yeah, exactly. Peanut butter and jelly.
Yeah.
So, more like peanut butter and pickles. I don't know.
Well, sometimes you want it to go together, though.
Right, so you do.
I don't feel sometimes like peanut butter ever
sometimes
goes with
people
pickles.
Love that.
Really?
Who loves I think pregnant butter? Ladies do.
Peanut butter and pickles? Oh,
right.
Okay.
I don't know.
Any pregnant ladies out there, let us know.
Right.
Do you love peanut butter and pickles? But anyway, so getting back to this scenario. So for you guys out there listening, a civil violation, if you recall from past podcasts, that involves money. That right. involves a violation, but it's not criminal. You can't go to jail for that. That you could get sued for that, right? Criminal violation, you could go to jail for.
Yeah, that's where your liberties at stake, right? Of course.
An ethical violation, that would be something where, you know, you shouldn't have done it. And that, for example, could get you into trouble with things like the State Bar Association, who licenses Myrtle.
That's right.
For her law license.
Right.
So what do you guys think? A, nothing wrong. B, ethical violation. C, civil violation. D, criminal violation.
And I guess let's be clear. Remember what we're talking about here. We know that Myrtle is completely aware that Jebediah just took the stand and lied.
Right.
So it's not a situation where she didn't know he was going to say that or anything like that. Like, she knows once he said it that he is lying. So Russ, will you please inform our good listeners what kind of trouble she's in, if any?
Sure. So she is in. So first, before I say this, there's multiple answers.
Mm-hmm.
So if anyone was just choosing one letter, think again. And well, you can stick with one letter, but you don't have to.
Especially when we're telling you that you're wrong if you do that. It's
very likely. I'm going to say about 100% chance there's more than one right answer here. So who knows? If you want to stick with one, go for it. That's for all the stubborn people out there. That's something that my daughter would probably do. Right. Well, I'm sorry. My answer is still one answer. All right. So the answer is B, C, and D.
Wow. Whoa, that's a world of trouble. Ethical, civil, and criminal liability for suborning perjury, huh?
Suborning perjury is exactly what she did. She knows that the testimony is false. She allows it to be stated under oath. When she knows that, she does not correct it. That is a criminal violation of suborning perjury.
Now, we gave you a hint last episode a little bit about this topic. So if you guys had your listening ears on, I think you might have done well here. Russ, let's just have a discussion, because I actually have been asked about this by people just like, okay, how do you deal with this situation? Okay, you want to represent your client. You want to let them take the stand. You want to put forth the best defense. Okay, so how are you supposed to sidestep this sticky issue here that Myrtle found herself in?
So if it's something like this where it goes to the actual jury decision in the case, you simply can't put that person on the stand.
Right.
Because you know that question's going to be asked. And you can't have them testify if they're going to confess.
No, wait a minute though, Russ. I think I heard somewhere, probably this exact podcast one time, that it's not the lawyer's decision about whether the person testifies, it's the actual client. So what if the client is demanding to get up there on the stand and testify? What's the lawyer supposed to do? The
lawyer has to tell that person that they have to testify truthfully.
And what happens if they don't? What duty must a lawyer do if they encounter a situation where their client is testifying falsely?
Have to advise the court. And that probably ends up in a mistrial.
Exactly.
So what happens?
What Myrtle needed to do in this situation, first of all, she needed to be more prepared and know exactly what her client was going to say before he testified. I will tell you, there's a school of thought out there in criminal defense where there are lawyers that say, you know what, client, don't tell me what happened. Don't right. tell me anything, because if you don't tell me what happened, then I don't know if you're lying and I can put you on the stand and you can say whatever the heck you want. Russ and I have been doing this for, you know, combined 45 years. We think that's a very bad approach, because right. you're putting your head in the sand. You need to know exactly what your client's going to say, because you need to know how he's going to be exposed for cross-examination.
Yeah, that is tantamount to ineffective assistance, to yeah. malpractice,
exactly.
essentially.
So what Myrtle needed to do in this situation is, upon the lie, she needed to approach the bench and say, Your Honor, I'm aware that my client just perjured himself. I have to withdraw from this case. I'm asking for a mistrial.
Yep.
I can't allow this testimony to stand.
Right.
And the judge, I think, would grant a mistrial.
Right.
He would be given a new attorney. And, you know, we'd probably start the trial over again with new representation.
Yep. That's how it would go. So hopefully everyone out there did well. You hopefully said, yep, B, C, and D, everything, but she did nothing wrong.
That's right. All right, guys. Well, thank you for playing Is This Legal? We're going to get back to our regularly scheduled programming. All right, welcome back. Hope you did okay playing our little trivia game show, Is This Legal? Let's end the podcast, Russ, with a happy story. I like happy stories, certainly that have happy endings. We alluded to this earlier in the podcast, but I want to talk about Robert Dubois. I'll call him. This poor guy spent 37 years in prison for rape and murder of a young 19-year-old woman, and it turns out he didn't commit this crime. So there was a woman who, in 1983, her name was Barbara Grahams. This is a case that took place in Tampa, Florida. She was raped and murdered. And at the time, the forensic evidence, and I'm using air quotes big time when I describe that, pointed to this guy, Robert Dubois, who apparently had absolutely no connection with the victim, but had been seen in the area where she was murdered. And the prosecution apparently relied on some bite mark testimony to suggest that, you know, tooth indentations that were found at the scene matched this guy's teeth. Well, this man has been completely exonerated. And I mean that, you know, they have DNA that indicates that this crime was perpetuated by two other people who are actually currently serving life in prison without parole for other heinous crimes.
Yep.
And so this man is out of prison, and he just settled with the city of Tampa for $14 million, Russ.
Yep, he got $14 million and apologies from the city council members and apologies from the Tampa Police Department. But let's go through for our listeners. Like, this is based on essentially two pieces of evidence. One is the bite mark evidence that you referenced, and the other is a jailhouse snitch.
That's right.
Okay, so
that's how this guy was convicted.
That's it. Those two pieces, and that's it. So let's first talk about the bite mark. Okay, I will tell you right now, bite mark evidence has been debunked now.
As junk science. It's useless.
It is useless. And it is useless because there is no certainty whatsoever when you have a bite in the skin, skin which is malleable, which stretches, which decays very quickly. There is no reliability whatsoever with matching up bite marks on someone's skin to actually to actual teeth.
Exactly.
Okay. That it doesn't exist. You cannot do that. Their expert sat there and opined that it was a match and it was him. And there were some problems with it. Like, first, the mold they took of his teeth were in beeswax, Colin. Beeswax is by all experts right now far too soft to hold a mold. So even how they did it, even with it being junk science, they didn't even do the junk science properly. Like, so they take a poor mold of this dude's teeth. The beeswax is soft. It doesn't hold the teeth mold. And then this expert opines that it's an exact match. That expert, by the way, since then has said, this was not reliable. I was wrong.
Yeah, he retracted his testimony. And by the way, was named as a civil defendant in Mr. Dubois' lawsuit against the city of Tampa, and he sued the police department. He also sued personally that expert, rightfully so. But at least the guy came out and apparently retracted his testimony.
So this is something that really bothers me because, you know, we can look back. This is in the 80s. You can say, well, that was back then, and we've now come far past that. But you know what? We haven't.
Right.
Because there's always some level of increasing, like DNA evidence, how much better it has gotten, right? Technologies are always improving. So like at any given time, there are problems with the technology that's always going to be improved.
Absolutely.
You know, you see, you know, I think you told me this stat. There have been 30 exonerations off death row.
This is the 30th exoneration of a person on death row in the state of Florida alone.
That's Russ. Florida alone. This
30.
This is where
I don't know what you guys think of that number. It's 30 too many.
Right. It's 30 people who are innocent who are either
37 years. I mean, this poor guy. He's 56 now. So I'm not good at math, but I mean,
he was very young.
He went in really young. He basically lost his life. He lost the ability to gain a livelihood, to get married, to have kids. I there's a lot here. I mean, honestly, $14 million in a way feels hollow.
Yeah.
37 years. How do you quantify that?
He was initially sentenced to the death penalty.
Oh,
and then that was reconsidered down to a life imprisonment. So, but you know who does a really good job with this is the Innocence Project.
Yes.
They
were directly responsible.
Yeah. They're the ones who pushed this. They're the ones who got the case reopened to have looking at that DNA evidence. Now, to the credit of prosecutors in Tampa, they did have a task force. And more prosecutors are doing this where they're looking at cases where there is a continued claim of innocence after years. And so they were open to looking at this case again. And so, and they did, and they agreed, hey, this was an unlawful conviction. But let's real quick. The other piece of evidence is that jailhouse snitch.
Right. I mean, this is just such a problem. Jailhouse snitch testimony is still used in prosecutions today, and it is just one of the most unreliable forms of evidence that exists. I really wish prosecutors would stop doing this. It's inherently unreliable, especially when you have a case like this where there's not a lot of evidence, where that becomes a really big focal point.
Yeah, that becomes the linchpin. And the informant in this case also walked it back and said that was actually a false statement. He never admitted to committing the crime, and I was pressured by the authorities to say that.
That's right. That's exactly right. So Mr. Dubois, I'm happy to say he is doing well. He's living in the state of Florida. He's purchased a house. He apparently has a good livelihood. He was quoted after he received this $14 million judgment. This is what he said. "I'm glad I don't have to spend any more years of my life pursuing this," Dubois told the Associated Press. "Money, houses, cars, none of that can ever restore what I lost, but I don't feel bitter about anything. I don't want to waste my time with bitterness and pity parties."
What a great perspective.
You know, kudos to you, Mr. Dubois. I wish you nothing but the best. And you know, Russ and I always like talking about these stories as a reminder of how many people are sitting there right now, as we're recording this podcast, innocent of the crimes that they're currently incarcerated or jailed for or waiting to be executed for. Yeah. So please let this case stick in the back of your minds, folks. This is a problem.
Everyone who is charged is not guilty.
That's right. So now that's a super happy note, but gosh, maybe it's time to strike a super stupid note, Russ.
I like it, and I believe it is your turn. What's it time for, Colin?
It is time for America's favorite segment, and if it's not, it should be. Darn it. So again, folks, we don't discriminate. We're for this one, we're going right back to our home state of Colorado. I mean, we're breeding dumb criminals here.
There are dumb criminals here.
In fact, Russ, this case is, you know, we didn't learn about this in the media or do some digging like we sometimes have to do. This is actually a case where Russ and I were front and center in a court waiting for our case to be called, and we witnessed
The dumbest criminal we've seen in quite some time.
Certainly of the week. And so, look, we're going to change his name to protect the guilty. We need the Colorado name, Russ. I'll do the first name. Colorado Hunter? How about a last name?
Good last name for Colorado.
Hunter
14er.
14er. So, Mr. 14er decides that he wants to purchase a motor car, much like Jebediah would.
It was a Subaru, I'm pretty sure.
Subaru motor car. He goes. It was a Subaru dealership. I think that's right. Mr. 14er goes into a dealership and he talks to the salesman about this beautiful Subaru that he's interested. And you know, they let him test drive the car. All's well. He takes the car out, but Russ, the problem is, he doesn't come back.
No.
The salesman calls the police and reports the theft. And the police, by our account, listening in the front row, they did a pretty thorough job of investigating this case. They pulled video footage from the dealership, and they were able to put together an idea of who this guy was. They even showed the salesman a photo lineup of six people with our DCOTW as one of the photos. The salesman immediately picked out Hunter 14er without hesitation, because the salesman produced a copy of Hunter's driver's license that he obtained when Hunter took the car out.
Yeah, turns out.
So Mr. 14er was caught with ease. Turns out he was on probation for car theft.
Yeah.
And he is now in prison.
Yep. So. Yep. Not a good series of events.
I mean, Russ, talk about being taken for a ride. I mean, What a clutch performance. So yeah, we actually got to see this fella, Mr. Fortiner, get sentenced right in front of our very eyes. What did he get? I think he got a year and a half or something like that.
Yeah, I don't remember, but it wasn't pretty, and it didn't take, you know, the detective of the week to solve this one.
I like that they actually went to the effort of putting together a photo lineup, despite the fact that the salesman got the driver's license right there. Well, you mean this guy? He's the same picture.
It matches.
I think it's this guy because he gave me his driver's license, detective. Right. So, okay, yeah, this is where we rate our stupidity of our offender. So 1 out of 5, Russ, what are we looking at for Mr. whatever his name
is? Mr. Fortiner.
Yeah.
I would have been probably at a 4 because he got away with the car. He drove away, and he could have, like, just driven several states away. But the fact that he didn't do that, and the fact that he was on probation for auto theft at the time that he does this incredibly, incredibly stupid auto theft, that bumps it to 5 for me.
Yeah. I'm going to give him a 5 too, man. Yeah. I just love the old, here's a copy of my driver's license so that if I ever commit a crime, you're absolutely going to know who I am.
Yeah.
So 10 out of 10. I mean, we're handing a lot of tens, it seems like, but gosh,
there's a lot of dumb criminals out there.
Stupid out there. All right, guys, we're going to call that a podcast. Please reach out to us, as some of you have. You can find us in several different mediums. You can, there's mediums that, you know, can communicate with the dead.
Right.
Not those mediums.
No.
But you can email us at denvercrimelaw, all one word, @gmail.com. You can find us at our Facebook page, Hebbets and McCallan. You can find us on Twitter, X, whatever you want to call it. Our handle is This Legal Pod. Drop us a line. Give us some feedback.
Feel free. I mean, we did, I'm happy to say we got more people after last episode agreeing with us and saying, I also thought that she was going to get, Jennifer Crumbly was going to get acquitted. So we really, really appreciate those. But we did get a message or two just saying, yep, I knew you guys were wrong on that one.
Yeah.
You were way off. So thanks for that too.
And you know, keep the feedback coming, positive or negative.
Right.
We'll take it all. All right, guys. Well, we will see you next time for another episode of Is This Legal? Bye-bye.
Johnny Law looked at me, said, Jebediah, can't you see them things you're doing just ain't right? Going around this town, stirring up a fright. Won't get far driving in your motor car. Look Cornelius right in the eye, said you ain't got proof, I ain't the guy. Said I may not wear no crown upon my head, I may not be regal.